Hello, and welcome to another episode of Enginerds, a monthly podcast about all things engineering, coming to you from Northumbria University, Newcastle in the UK. My name is Nick Martin. I'm sat here with Madeline Conbrink and special guest Dr. Gibran Khalid. Today, we're going to be discussing some interesting things going on in engineering over the past month or so. In this episode, we're going to be talking about some interesting engineering facts that we've found over the last month, and also we're going to look at some interesting new research that they've been doing at Newcastle University on 3D printed contact lenses. To start with, we'll go through and introduce a couple of people that you haven't met on the podcast before. So we'll start with you, Gibran.
Hi. My name is Gibran Khalid, and I'm working as a lecturer in Department of Mechanical and Construction Engineering here at Northumbria University. My research is basically based on ceramics and composites and smart materials. Talking a bit about smart materials, those materials which can actually give you some kind of information when you give them a signal. For instance, when you provide them electricity, they're going to change the shape, or when you change the shape, they're going to give you some electricity out. Why I became an engineer? When I was a kid, my radio was constantly broken. I didn't have money to actually fix it, so I started fixing it. And it made me realize, if I can fix a radio, I can fix other things also. So I started breaking other things just to fix them. And then I became an engineer.
I think we can all relate to that story. I've definitely broken things.
Yeah,
and they say the main reason people become mechanical engineers is to learn how to put everything back together that they have taken apart over the years.
Yeah. Great. So, okay, Madeline, what's... would you like to introduce yourself? That Madeline is the third member of the podcast, although she couldn't make it to the first pilot episode last time around. So, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, luckily, this week I have a voice. Last time I didn't. My name is Madeline Conbrink. I am a senior lecturer at Northumbria University. I'm an aerodynamicist. My research is focused on boundary layers, specifically boundary layers that is experiencing acceleration or deceleration. Where that is applicable is in all transport systems, from trains to aeroplanes, cars, or I used to work in the defense sector, so this applies to missiles and projectiles as well. Why I became an engineer? I didn't want to be an engineer at first, I wanted to be a vet. And my dad, really, my dad suggested at the time that before I make my final decision, I go and work with a vet for a week. Now, during that week, we just did castrations. It is horse castrations, cat castrations, dog castrations. So after the end of that week, I told my dad, yeah, no, this is really not what I want to do in my life. And then back then we still had Encarta Encyclopedia, because I grew up in the countryside, we didn't have internet, and I started looking for jobs, and I went on Encarta and I looked to see what a mechanical engineer does. And the first picture that came up was a picture of all of these engineers standing around a missile. And at that stage I thought, I would really like to work with missiles. That is how I decided to become an engineer.
Right, so at this point in the show, we're going to talk about some of our interesting engineering-related facts that we've kind of found over the last few weeks. And let's kick off in no particular order with Madeline. So what's your fact?
My fact for this episode is that the northeast of England, here we are at the moment, is the birthplace of passenger railways. But not only is this the first place where public railways was first available, it was also the place where the first tramways were being laid. The first public railway ever in the world ran from Stockton to Darlington, and that was called the Stockton and Darlington Railway, which operated from 1825 to 1863. And there were two gentlemen involved with that. They are both referred to as the father of railways. Therefore, railways of the world have two daddies. And they are named George Stevenson and Edward Pease.
But they were engineers, right?
Yes, they were both engineers.
Yeah.
Well, actually not. George Stevenson was an engineer, but Edward Pease was a businessman.
Ah, right, okay.
Yeah, you need a businessman.
All good kind of engineering stories have the engineer and businessman.
Exactly.
Or woman, we should say.
First of all, for me, that's very interesting because I didn't know about this part of England before I moved here 8 months ago. And this is a place of extreme importance historically. Not only did the Vikings first land here, but our railways started here and our public transport started from this very point. And then I went back a bit to look at the development of railways specifically in this part of the northeast. So the Stockton and Darlington Railway operated from 1825 to 1863. Then it became the Northeastern Railway from 1863 to 1923. There was a meeting and a new railway company was formed, or actually it was a merging of two railways, and then they became the London and Northeastern Railway and until 1948. And then this part of our railways from that point forward was called the British Railways. And the last steam train came into Central Station in September of 1967.
Oh, right,
cool. And that is when the steam and the steam train era in this region of the UK was concluded.
Yeah.
And from there it was diesel, and after that came electric.
Yeah. Oh, right, that's really interesting. So, I mean, most people probably know that the Northeast and Newcastle in particular is kind of famous as being a centre for coal mining in the UK. And that kind of, from what I've been reading about this, is what drove quite a lot of the development for railways. So, like, the original trains that were being developed up here, some of the first trains that were ever developed, were there basically to replace horses that were carrying or pulling coal along these, and at the time it used to be wooden tracks. And in fact, the first, one of the first trains built by William Headley, I think it was, so I think that was back in 1804, he built this kind of really massive steel locomotive type thing, but it wouldn't run on the wooden tracks because it was so heavy, it basically just crushed them. Obviously development's improved after that, but yeah.
But there's also a story there as why we still refer to horsepower.
Yeah.
Refer to an engine of horsepower or in terms of that is because of the horses that are drawn, the carriages, but the early trams were also drawn by horses.
Yeah, and also kind of like when early electricity was being made, initially they used to have horses to basically, you know, turn around and drive things like mills and things, and, you know, so kind of made sense to use that as a designation.
Yeah.
I still don't really know, I don't know how they measured specifically what a unit of horsepower was. They must have had like a test.
Yeah.
Like, you know, a certain horse could pull a certain amount per, I don't know, and that's how they, I don't know.
Well, that could be a very interesting fact for next time.
There we go.
Where does horsepower actually come from?
Yeah. Well, talking about railway, it's not my engineering fact, basically. But back in South Asia, during summertime, the temperature can go up to 50 degrees Celsius. And the railway tracks, they can be bent because of the severe heat. So what people, what engineers typically do over there is they leave a gap, a certain gap between, let's say, a kilometer apart. What happens is during summers, the railway tracks can expand and then they can connect to each other.
Yeah.
And during winter, they simply just shrink back to their original place. This is a really cool idea, because if they don't do it, then the railway tracks will be bent.
Yeah.
and then you have to fix it every single time.
But what happens in winter when the train tries to go over the tracks?
There isn't like a big a feet space.
Oh, okay,
the spaces
so just,
are really tiny.
Just enough.
It, yeah, exactly,
so,
because
yeah.
They're made up of steel, and steel, it doesn't expand much at these temperatures. It does
yeah.
expand, but it doesn't expand much.
Yeah.
So you typically leave, let's say, about 10 centimeter
yeah.
in between two tracks.
Okay.
And then they can just take up the space, and in winter they go back.
Yeah.
It is a really nice idea.
Newcastle and the North in general, because of the fact that there was so much coal industry, you know, back in like early Victorian times, it was actually like a real hub for technology development in the country. So there's a couple of, I have a couple of like random kind of Newcastle based facts for like firsts. So Newcastle, since we're on trains, Newcastle's central station was one of the first covered train stations in the world. In fact, it was the first covered train station
really?
In the world. Yeah. Mosley Street in Newcastle, which I don't actually know where that is. I want to go and visit it though. That was the first street to be lit by artificial light.
I have no idea where that is. We need to go and find it.
Yeah,
we definitely need to go and find it. And another random fact, which is kind of slightly less cool, is that LucasAid was invented in Newcastle. By a chemist, William Owen.
Okay.
What I want to know is what was he trying to do
exactly
to come up with?
I was just about to ask what was the original purpose of LucasAid?
Yeah.
Because Coca-Cola, the way I don't think the way we know it today, but it started off as a medicine for stomach ailments, and it only became a cool drink much later.
Yeah. I thought it was somehow related to cocaine as well.
You definitely want to edit that.
Okay, our next fact today, that's Gibran, it's your turn. So what's
yeah.
your fact?
So, since we are on the train topic, because Madeline just presented her fact, Sheldon Cooper from Big Bang Theory, he loves trains.
He also hates engineers, doesn't he? Or is very...
yeah, exactly.
Maybe he hates his strong
word. Yeah, yeah. So so I'm going to just twist the fact so it doesn't sound too engineering and not too scientific. But I'm not going to talk about the trains. In one of the episodes, Sheldon was quite afraid of a disease, so he actually didn't go to meet a certain guy. I actually forgot about the name. So he sent his robot... over there.
I remember
and
that episode. That
yeah,
was excellent.
That was an excellent idea. And in reality, this has actually become a reality. So there are certain people in the world and they have to be at two places in one time, which obviously they can't do it. So they come up with, well, they didn't come up, Sheldon actually came up with this idea. So they actually took his idea and they said, okay, how about remote presence? Which means that so patients who actually need the support of their doctor 24/7, obviously the doctor can be with that specific person 24/7. So if they are in a need, they can actually just press the button and then they're going to give a call to the doctor, and then doctor can actually attend to the person just like in a second, which is a really cool idea. And I mean, we can also do the same thing.
Yeah.
For instance, if I want to be in another place and I have to give a lecture, and I can simply sit in my office, just relax, and then I can just start talking on my computer.
So this is basically like Skype or FaceTime or whatever, but I have a robot basically
yeah,
that has
exactly.
a screen that basically projects your image and yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So what you can do is in that robot, you can actually have a cabinet with some, you know, some medicines inside, and then you can simply say, okay, in the cabinet one, you can actually open it and then take the medicine up. Obviously, you have the access code for that cabinet.
Yeah.
I saw an article a while ago about remote surgery. And for instance, if you have a specialist and, you know, there's a laparoscopic operation that needs to take place,
yeah.
it might be possible. I'm not sure if they're doing this already, but it might be possible to do remote operations.
Yeah, I think how this is going to work is at the moment we know that robots are taking over doctors or surgeons at the moment, and they are actually doing the surgery, not really the complicated ones, but you know, the normal ones, and you can actually give commands from a distant place, and then they can actually do the surgery on your behalf. So I think this is what they must be talking about, remote surgeries.
I mean, the robotic surgery in general is on the rise. There has there's been a lot of research being done into that at the moment. So, but I mean, it's not too difficult to think that if a robot can be doing it, then there's no reason potentially why you couldn't have a surgeon doing something remotely if there's enough cameras.
Yeah.
And, you know. Well, and you think about like keyhole surgery and stuff now. I mean, it is basically remote in the sense that, you know, you can't actually see.
Yeah.
You need cameras and things.
Of course.
You know,
so. Yeah, I mean it's a progressing technology. So obviously in 10 years time we will be seeing robots performing the surgery. Just like if you look back 10 years ago, I couldn't have imagined having a computer in my pocket.
Mm.
But now I have a computer in my pocket.
Well, it's already kind of happening. If you think about when you have laser eye surgery.
Yeah.
That's really, in essence, just a robot which is, you know, doing the
exactly
the stuff. It's not like you have a doctor that's like got the holding the laser in your hand.
Right now, where that will be particularly useful is there are doctors from the UK and from all over the world who volunteer their time in areas that's, for instance, war-torn, where there is conflict. So instead of sending someone a physical able body in, you can send in the technology and they can still help people, still perform their function, but do so from safety of a country that is not in conflict.
And I would like to do.
But there's far-reaching consequences for this, or not consequences. There's other areas where this will come into play, especially for those of us who's far away from our families. This will help us to stay more in contact with our families more regularly.
Well, that's an interesting point, because I mean, things like FaceTime and you know, doing
Skype,
video
yeah.
messaging, Skype and stuff, that's kind of, you could, there's an argument to say, well, you know, we're already doing it with this, why do we need to also have, you know, a robot body that moves around
yeah.
as well?
Yeah.
There's been some research done that showed that if you have humans interacting actually with
exactly.
something that's
yes,
actually semi-autonomous and moving around,
yeah.
that they actually, you know, the small things like being able to, you know, opening doors and stuff for the remote presence and
yeah.
stuff.
Yeah,
yeah, it's like
exactly.
You know, you have to interact in a more personable way.
Yeah, true.
And some of it goes towards touch. That people actually need physical touch, even if it is from a robot.
They want a physical presence.
Yeah, and there's a whole lot of research just done on the simple hug and how good it is for
yeah.
people to get a hug.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
even if it's a robot, if you can't be there in person, it will still be good for people.
Yeah, I think it's better than hugging a phone.
Or sleeping next to your tablet.
Would you ever hug a robot? I don't know if I'd trust it. What if they've not programmed the pressure response so that they're just
yeah,
crushing
but,
you?
Yeah,
but you can make it from plastic. It doesn't need to be metallic.
Yeah, I still would trust it. But that's the other problem, is how likely will people be to accept this piece of technology into society?
Yeah.
I mean, everyone has seen what's that movie, iRobot. That always comes to mind. What if they go evil?
Yeah, they're going to say, oh yeah, that's Jibra. No, I don't believe you.
And the interesting thing about iRobot is, even though everything that happened there was horrible, the robots never once broke the laws of Asimov.
Yeah.
They stuck to the laws of robotics. It just in a twisted way.
Okay, and so we're moving on to our last engineering fact, and that's my fact. And my fact this episode is that If you were to walk across the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel, it would take over 9 hours.
Wow.
And that's because it's over 37 kilometers long. And yeah, it's a pretty amazing structure. When it was first constructed back in the 60s, it was deemed as being one of the 7 modern engineering wonders of the world.
Wow.
And yeah, this thing, you should definitely Google it. It is impressive. So it's in it bridges across Chesapeake Bay, which is in Virginia, over on the east coast of the US. And yeah, so like I said, it's 37 kilometers long. It's got 5,000 supporting feet. But really, I think the most amazing thing about this bridge is that it's not just a bridge. You get more than just a bridge in this construction. It's a bridge and a tunnel at the same time. So basically, you're going along the bridge, and just when you're in the middle of Chesapeake Bay, it just turns into a tunnel, so it just dives below the waves.
Why?
And so it does this in 2 places, so that basically ships can get to, and you know, rather than having to go under the bridge, or rather than the bridge having some kind of like other system,
Yeah. I was going to say that, just like London Bridge, because the ships, they also cross London Bridge, and the London Bridge simply just opens up.
But then the traffic has to stop, whereas the Americans here at Chesapeake Bay,
yeah,
they don't have to stop, they
really
just carry on going underwater.
And it looks cool.
Another question is, can you see, what's the construction like? Can you see the sea life while you are driving through, or aren't we there yet?
No, it's kind of just like a boring tunnel.
Oh.
There's no windows to see out into the sea. That would be cool though.
Yeah.
That would be really awesome if you can make a little tunnel full of, you know, made from somewhere, some windows or see-through material. So you can do some whale watching while you're driving through.
I remember when I was a kid, the first time I went on the Eurotunnel, which is the tunnel that connects France to the UK, via, I think it's Folkestone or Calais, that kind of area.
Yeah.
And my parents were like, yeah, we're going on this tunnel, it's going to go under the water, under here. And I was like, this is so cool, we're going to see the fish.
Yeah.
It's going to be like sharks and whales. And yeah, it was just the most boring 20 minutes of my life.
Yeah. How long that is, the Eurotunnel?
So the Eurotunnel is about 50 kilometers long. So that's, in terms of how I've designated it, about a 15-hour walking time.
Oh, wow.
But if you wanted to walk across the longest bridge in the world, then you're going to be there a while. It's the Danyang Kunshang Grand Bridge. I've probably pronounced that terribly. But it's for the Beijing-Shanghai high-speed railway, and that is 165 kilometers long.
Wow.
But the nice thing about the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel, apart from the fact that it's a bridge and a tunnel, is it's one of the longest structures that actually goes over water. So obviously some of the longest bridges just kind of go across
land area,
whereas this actually spans.
You know how many bridges are there in Netherlands?
No.
How many?
12,700.
Wow. Mostly spanning water, I suppose? Or?
Yeah, mostly spanning water, because, you know, Netherlands is below sea level, and in order to avoid flooding, they have built all these canals and lakes and stuff. So, and they are in between 2 streets. So, if you want to cross a street, either you have to swim, or you can cross over the bridge. So I think the bridge was a nice idea. So
yeah,
that's why they have so many bridges. Although the Netherlands is a really tiny country, but they have so many bridges. Even on one street, you might be able to see like 3 or 4 bridges.
Yeah.
So most of those bridges open up from both sides?
Not all. Some of them, they open from one side, and some they just open like London Bridge.
So the Newcastle Bridge is quite interesting. I went there last weekend, and I wanted to see how it works, because I've never seen it lift up until I realized that it actually swings open.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'd like to go and see that one night or over a weekend. the way it swings open or swings upwards, the entire structures of the ships can pass through.
Yeah, and then there is another bridge in Netherlands, which I don't know the name because there are like plenty of them. So the bridge had a foot in the center of the canal, and then the bridge literally just swings like that.
Mm.
It doesn't go up, it just literally just moves horizontally, and then the ship, they can pass.
Yeah, so there's a few swing bridges along British canals, maybe a bit smaller, because it's
only... Yeah, of
canal,
course it has to be smaller, yeah, obviously, yeah.
Yeah.
St. Petersburg's bridges are interesting, because you need to make sure that you're not stuck on the wrong island. That's almost happened to me, is the city is made up out of different islands, and it's connected with bridges. At 12 o'clock at night, last time I checked, 12 o'clock at night, the bridges go up, and then there's a brief period of about 15 minutes, I think around about 2 o'clock, where they go down for 15 minutes again and then go up until the next morning. So
okay.
If you are
if you missed the 15 minutes.
If you miss the bridge...
then you're going for a swim.
Yeah.
Or even that, where you need to find a space to sleep.
So that reminds me actually of a mathematics puzzle which famously Euler solved back in whenever Euler was around, 17 something or other. And it's called the Seven Bridges of Königsberg, which obviously isn't St. Petersburg, but it's a puzzle where you have to traverse all of the different bridges without kind of coming back on yourself. And it turns out that it's related to graph theory and... Google it. It's quite an interesting puzzle. So on just coming back to my favourite bridge / tunnel, the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel. So one thing that I learned when I was looking at this is, did you know that you can have a phobia of bridges? And it has a natural name. So it's called gyrophobia. And that's basically fear of bridges. And for this particular bridge, because it's so long and it goes over water, and it has a tunnel, and fear of bridges is also kind of related to fear of tunnels. They're kind of, apparently it's a similar phobia. I don't know why, but anyway. So to overcome this, a cunning businessman in who obviously lives near Chesapeake Bay, has started a business called Kent Island Express, that where you can pay $25 to get transported across the bridge. And he was recently in an interview with the New York Times, and he said that construction workers have been known to ride in the back seat of their pickup trucks with hats pulled over their eyes and their ears plugged. A woman once rode with a blanket over her head, and a man asked to be put in his own trunk. The offer was refused. So, yeah. Fear of bridges is a real thing. But it just also goes to show that there's always a way to profiteer from something.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's move on to the final part of the show. Here we're going to discuss an interesting news and research article that we found over the past month. So it was some research done at the Institute of Genetic Medicine at Newcastle University, just across the road from us actually, where they were looking at 3D printing corneas for eyes, basically, to, obviously if you've got some kind of something wrong with your cornea in your eye, and then the idea is that you can print these replacement corneas that can then potentially, at some point down the line, be used for helping with those kind of conditions.
What makes this technique, what makes this unique is that they are using an ink dye to do the printing.
Yeah, exactly.
And they are growing it out in a radial manner. Something else that I picked up on the article was that even after they have printed the cornea, it still showed growth.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting actually.
Yeah. I mean, and the other thing which I did pick from the article, but you can actually control the dimensions, okay? If you have a lab-grown cornea, you can't actually control the dimension, but in 3D printing, you can precisely control the dimensions of your cornea. because sometimes if you have a bigger eye, you need a bigger cornea, you know, and then you can actually maneuver the size and the shape of cornea, which is actually quite an interesting technique to build the corneas. And cornea is not the only thing which can be 3D printed. There
okay.
are multiple human organs which can be printed, as complicated as a heart. So you can print a heart. People have printed ears before, they have printed liver, they have printed kidneys before. And yeah, because if you want to grow a heart in the lab, it's gonna take you quite a while, right? Because of the arteries inside, you have to place them so that they just simply just don't combine with the another artery. But with 3D printing, you can actually have the accurate dimension of the artery and actual place of the artery, and then you can actually grow the heart with 3D printing.
That's what is unique, because the ear that was grown on the back of the mouse,
yeah,
I mean, you can't really control it so much if it's growing.
True.
But you can, well, basically it's custom-made parts
yeah.
for humans. From the article, what happens is the patient will go in, his eye will be scanned, and the cornea that's printed will be exactly the same as the one he already had.
Exactly.
An
yeah.
interesting comment at the end of that article is someone said the next step of this will be to print the cornea onto the person's eye while they are, you know, in theater.
Hmm.
That basically we're going to start printing on humans.
Yeah.
That part
yeah.
I'm not so sure of, because I won't even do the eye laser eye surgery.
Yeah.
It's like next level laser eye surgery.
Yeah.
Because at the moment, I guess laser eye surgery, which we talked about earlier, that's where you're effectively removing aspects of the eye in order
yeah.
to improve vision, whereas here you're kind of doing the opposite.
True.
You're actually adding
something to the eye
materials.
Yeah.
yeah.
I won't do that for but that's just me. I've heard of plenty of people for whom it was quite successful, but
I don't have
that kind of trust.
Yeah, but you might need to develop new materials also, because at the moment, just like you mentioned, that they're using ink. And ink has to set at certain point.
Well, one of the things they were saying in the study actually was that there's been lots of people trying to do this. So the actual 3D printer itself isn't new technology. Really.
No, it's not. Yeah.
The thing that they've effectively done the novel aspect of the research is the fact that they've been able to create this ink, which is made from what are called stromal tissue or connective tissues, basically made up of the cornea of the person's
yeah.
eye, and then that ink has then been made to be a good compromise between being stiff enough so that it can
yeah.
hold its shape,
true.
But soft enough so that it can be extruded properly through
yeah.
it goes through the 3D printer extruder.
Yeah.
I mean, we should probably just talk a little bit about 3D printing in general, about, you know,
yeah.
a little bit more about what it is. So most people listening to this podcast maybe have an idea of what 3D printing is.
Yeah.
So, I mean, 3D printing is kind of comes under a broader term of what we call additive manufacture. And if you come and do your engineering degree at Northumbria University, then you'll definitely have a lot of exposure to these kind of techniques.
Especially in mechanical engineering.
Particularly in mechanical engineering, yeah. And, I mean, the first kind of 3D printing happened kind of back in the 80s with the invention of stereolithography.
Yeah.
So that's basically where you take a polymer and you use UV light to
yeah.
set part of the polymer to make, and then you put another layer of polymer on,
yeah.
set that, and then you can basically form a 3D structure by
yeah.
layering up different, layering up these layers of polymer. And then more recently, of course, there's been, it's kind of been, I would say broadly, there's two kind of main types of 3D printing. One is where you're kind of using that similar technique, so lithography, where
yeah.
you're basically taking a fluid or a powder or something and layer by layer kind of
yeah.
hardening that as you go
using
on.
Using the infrared rays.
Yeah, infrared
yeah.
and that kind of thing. Or kind of what potentially people might have seen, which is probably I would say it's a cheaper version of 3D printing, probably, which is...
It's a cheaper and easier version of the 3D printing, and it's called as fused deposition modeling.
Yeah.
And what happens in here is basically you have a filament which you have already made, and then that filament goes into the Olsen block. The Olsen block has a heater and the nozzle at the end. So what it does is you melt your polymer inside, and then with the with the nozzle you can actually just draw the structure which you have programmed into 3D printer. So you create one layer and then for subsequent layers on top of that, and then you're going to create your product in three dimension. Technically speaking, it's not really 3D printing, it's 2D printing, because it prints in X and Y, and then the stage actually moves in Z direction, which gives us the third dimension, and then we can call it a 3D printing.
You know,
the interesting fact about 3D printing is you can actually print food with 3D printing.
I've heard about this, yeah.
There's a cafe in London who are actually serving a 3D printed food. And
nice.
I can bet you don't want to eat that. It looks so amazing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You can have these cool structures from chocolate. And it looks so adorable that you just want to put it as a souvenir in your home rather than eating it.
I mean, just like there's engineering things that you cannot physically manufacture without,
obviously, yeah,
without 3D printing techniques. Obviously,
yeah.
There's obviously food that you can only make with a 3D printer.
Exactly. Yeah. And the other interesting fact about 3D printing is it's inexpensive, like you mentioned before, and it reduces human effort.
Mm.
For instance, if you want to make a car bonnet, okay, and you need few men, you need expensive instrument, and then you can make a bonnet. But using 3D printing, you can actually make a bonnet.
Mm.
Now, the question will be, how can you make a bonnet? Because bonnet is made up of metal, and we are talking about polymers. You can print metals, you can print ceramics also, just like the technique you mentioned before, using laser.
They use sintering techniques.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you start with the powder, and then you sinter the shape, and then you just move another layer of powder, and then you start sintering, and you can actually make the shape which you want.
Another bigger, well, literally bigger application of it is to print houses.
Oh yeah, exactly, true.
To solve the housing crisis, because you want to erect as many structures in as little time as possible. And
yes,
with the sintering technique, you can build a full functioning house in
something
like a day or two.
Yeah, exactly. But when you want to print a house, you don't need a sintering technique, because you can use FDM, which is fused deposition modeling, and you can print the house. There are houses which are being printed, and in Netherlands they will be printing houses, and people will be actually living in those houses in 2019. So Netherlands will be the very first country to build a habitable houses which are 3D printed. Because you know, when you construct a house, you have to follow some legislation. At the moment, the 3D printed house cannot follow those legislations, so they're actually working towards those legislations so they can build a perfectly safe house for human being to live
and perfectly insulated for this weather.
Oh yeah.
So I mean, from my background is in wind tunnel testing and aerodynamics, and you know, one of the things that's quite usually kind of related to 3D printing is another term which we use called rapid prototyping.
And
really that's one of the benefits of 3D printing, in the sense that, you know, it traditionally, if you'd have to say make something that involves making a mold, and then you'd have to say, you need to say, if you wanted to make something from a plastic and a mold,
true,
then you have to get all those materials machined, and you have to take it somewhere, and you have a specific manufacturer, and you have to get all the plastics right. And basically 3D printing kind of circumnavigates all of that stuff, so you can literally, you know, in one sense, draw something on your computer, and then you know, within an hour or two have a fully printed model. And you know, in Formula One, for example, which is where I used to work, then all of the wind tunnel model, practically, apart from like the base, what we call the spine of the model, that's more or less completely 3D printed with various techniques, like you were saying, stereolithography, but also
FDM
type techniques as well. So,
you know, the other cool thing about 3D printing is you don't need to know the CAD or the engineering drawing to actually make a shape. There are certain websites which are available and they have tons of designs. You can simply download the design, change the dimension, and then you can go and start printing.
Yeah, so things like FreeCAD, for example.
Yeah.
So we'll put some links in the show description notes
to
kind of link to some of these things. But yeah.
Gibran mentioned earlier that you can print with metal powder as well.
Yeah.
And that, well, Nick said from his previous occupation, he worked for Formula One. I worked in, you know, in the defense sector.
We're not printing a missile.
No, we're not printing a missile. But where that is useful is certain components which is hard to get or that you need for some of your systems can be printed with a 3D metal powder machine, and those are functional parts. And the 3D printing crosses over into the medical field.
It does.
It does a lot because how I was introduced to 3D printing is they showed us a 3D printed skull with a tumor sitting on it. And what was done then is the surgeon needed to operate on a person's brain.
Yeah.
And this was about 20 years ago, so the technology that we have today wasn't available. All that they had was the MRI scans. So the MRI scans were sent over to the university, and the university printed the skull from the MRI scans, and the tumor was made to be a different color. So the surgeon could see exactly what to expect when he goes into the person's skull to remove the tumor.
Well, again, that comes back to why, you know, 3D printing, if for example you want to build something in a dynamic system like a human body, which is changing, and you know, there's millions and billions of humans which all have different shapes, so if you needed to build, say, like a cast or a some kind of medical something that basically can be custom fit, obviously you can't,
for instance.
Yeah,
light valves?
Exactly. I mean, you can't make a billion different jigs in order to,
of course,
you know, or molds or whatever, whereas with a 3D printer you can make something bespoke for each individual person.
If you want to make a car which has different sensors inside, so what you need to do is, like Nick mentioned before, you need to have different molds for each and different single part, and then you have to make first part first, and then you have to put a sensor on top. Then you have to make the second part, then the third part. But with 3D printing, you can print first part, put the sensor on top, print the second part, put the sensor on, and then you can actually make the car. This is the research which is being carried out in University of Ohio, and they are actually putting sensors into some useful gadget, let's say.
Yeah, would you say that 3D printing is the manufacturing of the future?
Yes, it's the
3D printing, manufacturing in the future.
Yeah, yeah.
I think we could probably all agree on that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no doubt about that.
That's all we've got time for on this episode of Engineerds. If you want to get in touch with us, then you can do so via our Twitter handles. I'm on at @ND_Martin. Gibran.
@ Dr. Gibran Khalik.
Madman.
@ ML_Khalik.
Or you can email us at engineerds.co.uk. You can follow us on Twitter, that's @ engineerdsuk. And you can find all of our previous episodes, or one of them, on our website, engineerds.co.uk. Thanks for listening, and goodbye.